Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Today's guest is Michael Kavanagh, an award-winning writer, artist, and editor with the Washington Post Style section. He writes the weekly comic book / graphic novel blog Comic Riffs. Michael is also a cartoonist, and he worked on the 2012 anthology book Team Cul-de-Sac, Cartoonists Draw the Line at Parkinson's, which was nominated for a Harvey Award, which is kind of a big deal in the comic book world. Well, let's talk about the Team Cul-de-Sac project, because that's kind of an interesting place to start. What was your involvement in that?
Yeah, well, Richard Thompson, he's a tremendous talent, and I first met him about 2005. Recently been hired by the Post, and I did, at the time, the National Zoo, I had been through the San Diego Zoo, been through a pandemonium, if you will, with a newborn panda.
Was that your cartoon I saw with all the pandas
that
online?
That may have been the one.
Oh,
it's,
okay.
It's the one where this will tie maybe to a theme throughout our talk today. I satirized how the Washington Post was, on the whole, obsessed with the panda. With Butterstick, we called him, Tyshawn.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did was, at the time we had morning critiques in the Post, and people drew it. And part of a theme of my life is always bringing visuals to the verbal and verbal to the visuals. So I became the first person to actually draw my critique. And so I did panda. I laced the entire newspaper with panda themes. And and I parodied A Modest Proposal, Jonathan Swift. His satire is kind of what runs through my
veins.
So
are we going to eat pandas? Is that what you're telling
us? Exactly.
Oh,
that's the future. That's why they call them Butterstick, a little few pancakes, and
Now I'm concerned about posting this podcast because this is sort of almost a sacrilegious conversation to have in Washington D.C.
It absolutely is.
Oh my God!
I hope all irony is coming through this iron microphone.
They're going to be crowded at my door with torches and pitchforks.
I'll leave before any of this hits the airwaves.
So anyway,
but Richard Thompson was kind enough to reach out to me and tell me how much he liked it, and said thank you. And then I started looking into Richard Thompson's work and realized, as others have done, Nick Galifianakis, local cartoonist for Carolyn Hacks, is among those who said you meet him, you talk to him, and he's so humble. Took a little while and realize he's the genius. He's one of the, considered in recent years one of the greatest living comic strip cartoonists. Several years ago, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And I said, I need to write about this for the Post. And so what I found out is he was maybe not only the most universally liked cartoonist in the business, certainly in the comic strip world, but maybe the most universally respected. And so I reached out to write this piece. I reached out to Gary Trudeau, Bill Watterson, talks to no one, and he was willing to talk to me about this. And because he respects Richard that much, in fact, Lick, in a couple months at the Billy Ireland Ohio State Museum, there will be a Richard Thompson Bill Watterson co-exhibit.
Oh,
he respects him that much. I believe March 22nd it begins. I realized I reached out from Mike Peters, Stefan Pastis, Pat Oliphant, the great political cartoonist. Everybody loves Richard, and everyone wished him the best. But as I saw his skills decline with his hand, I thought I need to write about this. So I wrote a long Post magazine story. It's one of those I self-assigned and spent about.
Someone needs to write this.
Yeah, exactly. And most of my favorite ones were self-assignments. It was about someone who they had a quality that I found so compelling. So the piece I wrote was a combination. Let's look at Richard as his skills are atrophying, and yet he's at the peak of his game. That was the cruel irony. He was at 53. And he had only recently been daily syndicated with the strip cul-de-sac, and now this happens. Mm-hmm. And everyone in the field felt for him. You finally reached the mountaintop, and now your skills are betraying you. But I also used it to look at the larger comic strip industry, because he wasn't selling to near as many papers as a genius comic strip should. So I looked at comic strips and newspapers and the change there, and sort of the ills of the industry through the prism of that. And I also looked at where we are with Parkinson's research, talked to people at Johns Hopkins. So Team Cul-de-Sac was a partnership started by Chris Sparks, who met Richard Thompson at a convention. he spearheaded Team Cul-de-Sac. He got all these cartoonists aboard. There was a book with more than 100 cartoonists contributed their work, including people like...
It's a great book.
It's a, thank you. It's a, and Chris, you know, on behalf, he really got it done. And I wrote, the piece I wrote for the Post became, it's the main text for the book. And it's the window into, the verbal window into all these great contributions by top cartoonists in the field.
Yeah. Now, is it still available?
Oh, yeah. Why, you know, you can buy it bookstores, to, you know, mortar to online.
No, anybody who has a passing interest in cartoons should take a look at it, because it's just a really wonderful examination of somebody's life, somebody's skills, and cartooning in general.
And I should note, this was for charity. And so Team Cul-de-Sac was a partnership with the Michael J. Fox Foundation. And they do matching. So, like, there was a Bill Watterson painting that sold for a lot. It was, you know, his first public art in almost 16 years. So Cul-de-Sac as a charity was able to raise more than $50,000 last time I heard. And it was matched, so over $100,000 has been raised for Parkinson's research, thanks to Team Cul-de-Sac.
Well, good. Excellent. That's a great, great story. Yeah. Let's back up a little bit about something you mentioned in passing in that story about the state of the comic strip. You know, in my lifetime, I've seen the decline of the comic strip. I didn't, you know, I'm not that old that I remember the heydays of the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. But since the 50s, in which they point to things like television, as one of the leading factors as to the decline of the comic strip. Could you sort of talk about that? And
absolutely. I mean, I entered daily comic strip syndication in late 1996 with United Media, and is with my comic strip Warped, and I did that for 7 years. So I was at the drawing board every day. And I'm like, I finally made it in daily syndication. And then I
saw... In a dying art farm.
Yeah. I mean, at the time, it was still... This was late 96. They were still seen as somewhat rigorous. Because 95, in 1995, you still had, Bloom County. You still had Calvin and Hobbes. You still had The Far Side.
Oh, my God.
And within roughly the 12-month period... all would disappear from the landscape. And all, you know, being carryovers from the 80s, people, you could still, I think, have a common conversation with so many people about those strips, as well as Doonesbury and other strips. But those, once those quickly in the mid-90s all disappeared, it was a radical shift. Now, Dilbert was able to rise, but that became popular largely through the internet and email. And Scott Adams, you know, capitalized on that. And you had the rise of Zits, but really when those left, we have not returned to that heyday. And so I lived it. By the time I voluntarily ended my comic strip in 2003, because I thought this, you know, one, I artistically had said what I wanted to say. But I also, you know, if I'd been in 500 papers, I might have, like a lot of cartoonists said, I'll just keep grinding it out. But it was a massive shift, and syndicates just don't release that many strips. I've talked to Gary Trudeau about it. He said even when Doonesbury was syndicated in 1970, he felt like the ebb had begun.
Mm-hmm.
But the radical shift has been, you know, the decline of print readership. And so we've really seen in the past couple decades that drop off, that as you've seen circulation drop off, if you've seen two newspaper towns become one newspaper towns, that's all endemic. You know, I got into journalism and cartooning because I thought I'll ride two horses. I'll be an editor and a writer, and I'll be a comic strip cartoonist and cartoonist in general. And if I have two horses, and if one horse dies, I can jump on the other one, almost like Butch Cassidy and Sundance or something.
You remember what happened to them at the end of the movie.
Exactly. I've had to leap into a few gorges along the way and avoided Bolivia. You know, it's or professional Bolivia, but what's happened now?
Yeah,
I know. But what's happened now is I realized that because of newsprint, I wasn't really riding two horses. I was probably just moving around the saddle on the same horse,
right?
Because it was all linked to what is on newsprint and print readership, and they both industries, which are inextricably linked, are making, you know, still wrestling with how to live in a digital world.
So where are the strips in the digital world? I know that there's some syndicates that post their strips online, and some papers have their content online. I mean, is that universal through most papers in big cities, et cetera?
Or? Yeah, most papers still have a portal. You know, you collect comic strips. Some of the syndicates provide as a service, you know, ways to help facilitate that. The Washington Post still has, my understanding is, one of the biggest online strip collections paid for, not just linked to, but where we actually pay for these online strips. But if you're a creator, you're still making, you know, cents on the dollar from a digital pay. Like when I would get picked up by a digital client, say a Portland Oregonian would buy me digitally, suppose the San Francisco Chronicle was carrying me in print, I would make a fraction of what I made. So it's tough on creators. But the Washington, you know, these newspapers are still one of the main portals. And the Washington Post gets millions upon millions of page views every month just for comics. So when people say comics are dying, well, what it really is comic strips are dying. If I want to make sure to say that. It's really that print readership is aging and younger readers find them digitally. And you're seeing that shift in readership. But it's, I think what we'll see in the next generation is with the rise of webcomics only and what people like Kate Beaton and Matt Boers are able to do, I think we will see, and through things like Tumblr, I think you'll see different portals, and I think it will shift where people go to find those webcomics.
Yeah, it's funny because comics really kind of came, were born out of newspapers,
absolutely,
the comic strip,
yeah,
and even comics, I guess, in America. They,
yes,
they came out of,
yeah,
comic newspapers. The first is on the editorial page, but then gradually as entertainment.
Is with Yellow Kid.
Yellow Kid.
And the New York, you know, publishing wars. Yeah,
so. Yeah, and things like that. And the comics sort of evolved into a feature like the sports section, mm-hmm, that maybe not everybody was reading them, but it was bringing eyes to your paper,
yeah,
that wouldn't necessarily see it, that people actually sought out the paper because of the comics, because, mm-hmm, of that feature.
Yeah.
So, you know, certainly with the decline in print readership, you know, it's funny that you said that there's still people who are primarily or a good chunk of the reason they're going to search out these newspapers is still the comics.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But we're sort of one lifetime away from what I'd say was the peak, because I interviewed last year Mort Walker, the creator of Beetle Bailey, who just turned 90. And Beetle Bailey was the last comic strip personally approved by William Randolph Hearst.
Wow.
And so, which means that he's that one degree link back to the height of the newspaper wars and when everyone was reading Little Orphan Annie. And there's the famous story about Little Orphan Annie when the newspapers went on strike. It may have been the mayor of New York.
Fiorella
LaGuardia.
Yeah, exactly. My mom told me that story.
Yeah.
She remembered hearing him read the paper.
LaGuardia, can you imagine? I don't know. I think this was late 40s, perhaps,
yeah,
mid-century. Can you imagine a mayor of a major town now getting on, in the middle of a newspaper strike, getting on the radio to read to you, mm-hmm, the comic strip to say, you know, you this is our collective soap opera and I need to tell you what's going on.
Yeah, my mom used to joke about it. She said he'd get on the radio with this thick Italian New York accent and Little Orphan Annie,
yeah,
did this or that.
Which is so perfect because early comic strips are so much about the immigrant experience too.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of perfect. I wish LaGuardia around now to champion it.
Well, and you also mentioned Billy Ireland Museum, which, mm-hmm, just opened at Ohio State. Well, I shouldn't say it just opened. They opened up a new museum,
yeah,
the collection. Milton Caniff started it in the 70s. He was a graduate of Ohio State. Billy, mm-hmm, Ireland was a cartoonist at the Columbus Dispatch,
mm-hmm,
and Caniff had worked for him, and so Caniff donated his personal papers and his drawings to sort of kickstart the program,
mm-hmm,
and that's grown and grown and grown, and people have contributed comic strips and artwork. I know that also was it Bill Blackbeard was the man who,
mm-hmm,
he had a museum on the West Coast, and he gave his sizable collection of comic strips to the museum. I think it was like 90 semi or tractor trailers,
wow,
worth of material to the museum,
yeah,
to fill out their coffers. So they needed more space.
Yeah.
So they opened, for everything I hear, you know, I'm going to have to go there at some point.
Mm-hmm.
It's it's a place, it's a mecca where people can go and view lots of old strips, but also sort of do research and things like that. Mm-hmm. So you've been out there yet? Or
No, I'm going in March for the Richard Thompson, Bill Watterson show, which I've written about. And I quoted both a couple months ago on my blog, which, by the way, you can find. It's Comic Riffs is the name of the blog on the Washington Post site. But I interviewed both Bill Watterson and Richard Thompson about the opening and their mutual admiration society, and how deeply honored they, you know, they're humbled to be in each other's company.
So, they're effusive in their they're humble praise of each other.
Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about your column. It's really I find it really fascinating because you obviously you're writing about comics and graphic novels and things, and your background as a cartoonist. And is also a feature writer and an interviewer. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that I like about it is that you actually bring in visual elements to help tell the story. You'll you'll create videos that have cartoon elements. Mm-hmm. It'll be set up like a panel of a comic strip. You'll have the speaker in the leftmost box inside the screen, and then as that person is speaking, then images will work their way through in the middle and the right panels. Mm-hmm. So again, it's sort of you've animated a comic strip to help you tell your story.
Yeah, that seems very natural. I mean, you know, I grew up it was sort of, you know, not only did I have one parent who is politically conservative and the other politically liberal. So growing up, you sort of, you know, I use that as a metaphor, too, because then you look at both sides, I think, and try to take something from each or be more clear-eyed about it. Well, I also grew up at home with my dad was a big journalism fan, reading San Francisco Chronicle. He was a big Herb Cain guy and a sports guy. But he's a lawyer and a writer. And my mom's a visual artist and a teacher. And so by osmosis or just – I grew up in a home.
It's in your genes.
It's in my genes. Well, what I grew up with was just naturally picking up sort of being sensitive to verbal literacy and visual literacy. And so I've spent my life sort of trying to combine that. And, you know, so what I do in the blog is I recently wrote about graphic novels in the classroom.
Yeah.
Because I had a young relative who was told graphic novels aren't books.
Well, of course they're not, but go
yeah,
on.
Yeah, exactly. And as I pointed out, how many years, decades are we past A Contract with God by the great Will Eisner or Mouse or Persepolis and American Born Chinese and all these landmark works that have been acknowledged as literature? And so in writing that, and you can find that, the direct URL, if you go to wapo.st@graphicnovelsinschools, so wapo.st/graphicnovelsinschools.
And I'll have the link with this.
Great. Thank you.
This as
thank
well.
You. But what my young relative being told that's not a book launched me into sort of this year-long project where when cartoonists would come to town at Baltimore Comic Con or National Book Festival or Small Press Expo or elsewhere, I would or some of them I would just have it to bring them to the Post newsroom when they were on tour. And I did video and would talk to them about literacy and graphic novels and what it means to them. So I ended up at the end of the year animating with a friend, Tom Racine, five of these. And then I worked with Sohail El-Jamai, an artist at the Washington Post. And I also did animations. So there's 7 looped animations. There's 5 animated videos. And I did other illustration and photo gallery. Basically, to say, why not just, it would be absurd to just say, oh, I'm just in text going to tell you why in schools graphic novels are important and tap 2 different types of intelligence, fire more of your brain. There's a bias that, you know, you go from picture book to prose and that's how you grow up as a reader. That's mature. Mm-hmm. But actually, as Linda Barry talks about in one of these animated videos I did, and these are the first animated videos the Post has ever done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to help in my own small way pioneer storytelling in within the Post is, you know, one form of storytelling is that Linda Barry talks about, you know, language is fired in one part of the brain and in the opposite hemisphere you have visual
animation on that.
And musical will fire somewhere else. And so why not tap all of these? And you know, bringing back to the newspaper, we don't question why in a newspaper we run big photos next to the stories, you know, why it's not all gray, you know, why you have a shot of RG3 next to the column by Jason Reed or something, or a Boswell column in Strasbourg. I mean, you appreciate that sort of double approach to coverage, but with graphic novels, somehow people there's a prejudice because they think of graphic novels, they think of comics, and they think of superheroes, they think of balloons, they think of capes, and they think, you know, there's that prejudice.
Yeah, you know, in World War II, when which most people refer to as the comic book golden age, yes. When there were all the first wave of superheroes and yeah. lots of other different types of westerns and war comics and things like that, that a lot of the material that they shipped over to troops mm-hmm. were comic books because Absolutely. That's what they were reading. And when they came back home and their taste changed and the medium changed brought them – more adult themed. I mean, adult as in sort of film noir, sort mm-hmm. of mystery, crime, sure. and that sort of thing, and yeah. horror eventually. Yeah. I mean, that's where the tastes were going, but mm-hmm. That kind of all boiled over into the things that happened to the comic book industry in the 50s and congressional investigations and Seduction of an Innocent Book by Dr. Wortham, which I guess recently somebody had published a.
What's been discredited?
It's been discredited
wildly.
That's the,
yeah. Well, Carol Tilley. You know, scholars have went back and Carol Tilley is one person I cite is who they went back and for years people have thought, well, Wortham maybe skewed in 19. In 1954, a Senate subcommittee based its findings. On Wortham's studies, and he would write Seduction of the Innocent, basically saying that comics led to juvenile delinquency. And, now it sounds absurd on its face to any thinking person, but this was in the era of McCarthy era hysteria, and this sort of hysteria lapsed over into comics. You would have thought that they were all printed in the Soviet Union or something.
Right.
I mean, it was that intense. And more recently, it's what's happened is we've found out just how non-scientific his studies were, the degree to which he skewed his studies. He basically... It was almost the equivalent of deciding what his findings would be and
right.
then talking to kids and basically, dumbing up the research to match what he wanted.
From what I read even before this, where he would talk to juvenile delinquents
mm-hmm.
and say, people who were in jail or in mm-hmm. juvenile hall or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, he would like, oh, do you read comic books?
Yeah.
And they said, yeah, I read comic
yeah.
books. And so then that.
Ipso facto.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That was sort of, but anyway, the reason I sort of bring up this discussion is that, it was sort of this feeling that comic books and comic strips and things were either bad for you mm-hmm. or they were for children.
Mm-hmm.
And that's as long as I got into comic books in the 70s, as long as I've been doing that, that's always been the perception, mm-hmm. no matter how it's gone up and down, but there's always, it's always been part of the discussion that,
mm-hmm.
oh yeah, well that's, people who read those things, they're not smart or, they don't read, as well as other people. And that's not true.
Yeah. Well, and what I would point to is, look, I went through this progression myself. I was a comic strip reader as a boy and mm-hmm. I'd read, Peanuts not long after
yes.
Dr. Seuss. And then I progressed from that to reading graphic novels. And then I got heavily into political cartooning. So I, as a reader, was into that. And then at 19, I did political cartoons. In fact, I did one at 19 for a major metro, and it was at San Diego. And my very first one drew a lawsuit threat. And I thought, I'm on the right track. This is very cool. So
you're a journalist.
Yeah, I'm a journalist. We what's funny, and when I went last year, they screened it was screened at the museum a documentary about Herb Locke, and
Washington Post cartoonist.
Exactly, legendary, multi Pulitzers. Over 50 years.
I met him once. He just spanned.
Yeah, and he died. I think right before 9/11. So he reached into the century. He had a cartoon about Nixon, about Watergate leading back to the White House within a week after the break-in.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it points to what you can do in political cartoons that you can't do almost anywhere else in the paper. So we allow, because of the content with political cartoons and because of the tradition, we allow that. Now, part of the perhaps the irony here is that back in Tammany Hall, you know, it was Thomas Nast who really is the American, you know, grandfather, the political cartooner, godfather. And Tammany Hall, it was Boss Tweed who used to say, you know, in the 19th century, you know, I don't care. A lot of my voters can't read, but they sure can tell what a picture, you know, what I'm doing. If Boss Tweed's being, you know, has his hand in a money bag or, yep. you know, they can get that. And so there is that elemental power of the political cartoon that still hasn't gone away. So to me, what I write on the blog is all of this. To me, it's all of a piece. You know, it's all a medium. I write about animation, political cartooning, from strips and graphic novels to just illustration in general. It all taps a similar power. You know, both Ray Charles and Willie Nelson used to say, it's the marketers, it's the producers who need to put music in little boxes. We need to call it gospel or R&B or rock mm-hmm. or country. It's people, smaller minds who are uncomfortable or people who need to sell it and carve out right. a niche. But Ray Charles just like, you know, hey, it's music.
I'm going to do a country album. Exactly. I'm going to do, blues.
Someone yeah. of Ray Charles' virtuosity can do it all. And so, comics and cartooning get, labeled in little boxes, but those come with prejudices. Among readerships, but look, it's all of the same medium to me, and it all dovetails so much of it beautifully with journalism.
And I think you mentioned Peanuts. Peanuts is a great strip that I think a lot of people on a very basic level they recognize that there was a depth to that strip mm-hmm. that was not immediately apparent. That
yeah.
there was a cynicism. Yeah. There was a social commentary that was in it, you know, as they were playing baseball, Charlie Brown was, trying to kick that football. There were things that he was saying about life and the human condition
yeah.
that I think people recognize, and that's why they loved it so much.
Yeah. There was such a deep psychology, and then it dovetailed perfectly, especially, launched in 1950, but it took a few years to really get going. It launched, I think, in only 12 papers. But the late 50s, early 60s, we started seeing the rise of psychiatric therapy in mm-hmm. people. And so the fact that Schultz wrote about children but with a deep psychology mm-hmm. Kind of dovetailed with where the country was and that worked well. But there's still that resonance because recently I was talking to Chris Ware, the great graphic novelist, who's, I believe, about 50, and he said when he was a kid, when A Charlie Brown Christmas was on, he used to go up and kiss the TV, like during the Linus speech. It was so moving to him. Mm-hmm. But he said it's the only comic strip he read as a kid that he still considers literature, that it was that deep and profound.
Mm-hmm. I can remember moments when, it took me a long time to speak openly about the fact that I've collected comic books on and off for decades. And I'm not hot and heavy on it at the moment, but I can picture in my mind where I was, what the comic book was, what the story was, where I was so involved in the story, and we get to the final page and the main character is killed
mm-hmm.
and I feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And, I reflect back on that, years later and realizing, well, these are, this is like TV shows or movies.
Sure.
These are just images that are created to make us feel a certain way.
Exactly.
But the power of the fact that here is something that is just somebody has drawn on paper and put words to and has somehow had convinced me for that moment in the reality of that experience and the reality of that person
mm-hmm.
has a lot of power and a lot of – and. You know, I see it in other graphic novels that I've read, and I think that's the appeal of it. I think that's why we watch TV. I think that's why we watch movies to have that experience, that drama that speaks to us as human beings.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I one book I recommend to a lot of people that I wrote about in my graphic novels in the classroom piece is Stitches by David Small. Came out in 2009. To me, it's a profound memoir because it talks about as a boy, he was the son of a doctor, and there were some issues with his parents that, somewhat atypical. But also, his dad used, in the early days of using radiation and medicine, would test it out in his boy a lot, and then his boy, you know, mid-book spoiler here, his son, the author, wakes up one day, his dad is had a doctor do surgery on his boy, and basically he's voiceless, he can't speak. He had developed throat cancer.
Oh, wow.
And years later, his dad says, I think it may have been because I used so much radiation on you. It's a powerful, the art is so wonderful, and it is evocative of the 60s and late 50s as Mad Men. The close-ups, it's cinema. You mentioned film. It's cinematic. You all of a sudden, you'll get a boy's view, a 10-year-old boy's view, a close-up of a tumbler of brandy being poured or whatever, or vodka cocktail, and you see minks, women wearing minks and gloves. And David Small knows how to tell, and he also, the prose is so precise. And so that's what I say to people. Part of, again, the prejudice I see is people think, oh, if it's pictures, it devalues, you know, the prose must not be as great. I just would challenge people to read that and look at how artful it is, both in, you know, he has such a high verbal and visual literacy that it engages you on both levels. And emotionally, it's more powerful emotionally for that reason.
And it really comes down to you opening up,
yeah,
and getting beyond your prejudices.
Exactly.
You know, France and Japan are two countries that a lot of people point to, where the comic book is considered an equal art form, mm-hmm, as, you know, as drawing as cinema.
Mm-hmm. And the Netherlands and Korea,
yeah,
and
yeah. Yeah, they, for whatever reason, culturally, they don't have the same prejudices that we do.
In some ways, I'll say, especially, you know, certainly in Europe with the history and parts of Asia, sometimes I think they're more secure with their literature. They're secure. They're secure. That
we've got New World.
We've got New World. We still have New World-itis and a little old world envy, I think. You know, we in America, we love being, you know, worshiping youth as a new world. But if you look at the comments thread, there's about 120 comments right now on my graphic novels and classroom piece. It was more divisive than I expected it to be.
I'm surprised at that, too.
Yeah, there was one wave and then a second wave and a backlash, and I was very surprised. But, you know, whenever we sort of work within a certain type of community, sometimes we need to be reminded, you know, you can get a little insular, what is out there. And the bias and prejudices, whenever there's a bias or prejudice about anything,
mm-hmm,
and if you for a while get a little bit insulated, then you face that again. It can be a harsh reminder. But it's, and I don't mean, you know, to lather on the import of this is you know,
right,
social
this is,
prejudices.
Yeah.
I'm
right,
just speaking literarily, academically here. But a couple of the commenters said, well, this is why, you know, America's lagging, because you just want us to read comic books. You know, look at the economic income scale. Well, if you go to look at that, and if, you know, some scales have us, say, roughly in the mid-teens,
mm-hmm,
many of the countries ahead of us actually have no hang-ups. They have no issues with reading comics. Many of them, like in Japan, you see executives on the train reading, you know, manga and in big
digest size.
They're secure.
Magazines.
We are the ones who are insecure and figure we need to get to the big boy books. And you know, to me, you know, the fact that Dickens, you would have illustrations and one of my idols and through lines of keep coming back to my touchstones is Mark Twain. And the fact that those, you know, Huck Finn would be beautifully illustrated. And more recently, Charlotte's Web, a kid's book. But, you know, Garth Williams' illustrations are so poignant. We don't have quite the same prejudices if the illustrations are just in a novel. But if we get too many pictures, the bias erupts.
They don't illustrate novels the way they used to, because there was, in the early 20th century, there was a whole crop of very famous illustrators,
mm-hmm,
who illustrated, you know,
yeah,
Treasure Island,
sure,
and all these other books that, you know, yeah, they're kind of popular fiction, but a lot of people were reading and you know, wonderful artwork.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not the same thing as a comic strip, but,
yeah,
you know, the just bringing art into the narrative space is, you know, we just don't see it anymore. And I'm sure that it all just comes down to money.
Well, yeah, I mean, what we're seeing now, of course, in the more in the youth market is like what Jeff Kinney has revived, what I would call the illustrated novel for kids with the Diary of a Wimpy Kid franchise. And that has become the bridge, and I don't mean a Chris Christie bridge, but I mean a very functional bridge between that teachers and educators can accept because there are swaths of text in between the mm-hmm. pictures, and because it doesn't have to word balloons, and but more what we're seeing is. I talk to teachers who say, look, I spoke at Politics and Prose last year, moderated a panel, and the first person with a question during the Q&A was a teacher from Northwest.
I want to get these kids to put down their graphic novels.
Yeah, yeah. She said, you know what, I was one of those mean, you know, reluctant, those mean teachers who didn't get it. And then I saw my kids reading. I saw reluctant readers carrying them around and engaged. And as Neil Gaiman said in a talk in London last year, which I quote in my piece, Why try to, you know, quash a children's love for reading? Why would you want to foster that any way possible?
Right.
As long as it's appropriate material, beyond that, get them interested in reading first, and you can build on that.
I know that my own personal experience with comic books, reading comics in the 70s, and DC at the time had the license to the Edgar Rice Burroughs mm-hmm, books mm-hmm. and doing these wonderful Tarzan by Joe Kubert.
Sure.
And they adapted some of the novels and some of the science fiction novels. And I picked up the novels to read them, mm-hmm. and that led me into other science fiction, and that led me into greater literature from that. And yeah. So that was my own journey as a reader and somebody who makes a living editing and writing and just sort of linking on to, the word and how, what that sort of played in my life. But mm-hmm. recognizing the fact that the comics, Mad Magazine, mm-hmm. had an impact on it
yeah.
at that time. So
absolutely.
I think, you know, it's not the cure for everybody, but it's something that's out there. And like you said, you know, why say no to getting people to read?
Yeah, I'm not saying this is mandatory in every classroom. I'm saying this is yet another curricular tool. I mean, music is a tool, and music's also
right.
a tool for the way it's a tool for memorization. Basically, what I've seen is, you know, I saw firsthand in my young relative someone who had a strong spoken vocabulary, but was, you know, hit a glitch in reading, but got into Calvin and Hobbes. And this is many, many years after Calvin and Hobbes had stopped. It's, you know, it's been, he retired at like 15, more than 15 years
ago.
And
there's a really good documentary out now.
Yeah, there's Dear Mr. Watterson, and, which looks at sort of why, like, Peanuts, why Calvin Hobbes, our love of the strip persists, and why it's still relevant. But I saw, because it's so artfully done, I saw my young relative engaged by the picture, saying, okay, I need to know what this says. And once that kicked in, it was like a tripwire off to the races. And mm-hmm. next thing you know, going Peanuts to Zits, and then a Twilight graphic novel. And then,
oh well, you stop there.
Yeah, I know. It's something you can't always predict or guard against where this might lead. You just gotta go.
But let them go.
Yeah, but then it becomes pure prose, and you know she writes herself, you know, in on Tumblr a lot. And another thing I'd say is I believe we're becoming a more visual culture. As I write, just a couple generations ago, just a couple decades ago, we weren't bombarded on a daily basis by hundreds or thousands of images, most of us, you know, unless you were a photographer or photo editor. You know, even going through a textbook. As a kid, I used to love to get in the, you know, put the encyclopedia on the floor and thumb through. But now, just say you spend 2 hours in the computer, and the way kids do, you know, thousands of images. And I believe we're raising a generation that is hyper-visual.
Mm-hmm.
And they will demand to be, you know, have both verbally and visually stimulated. And I think that will change. It will change what creators provide. I mean, you know, what is a meme anyway? You know, most memes are just matching a visual to a verbal. And those go like wildfire. There's a reason it has to do with brain function.
Now, the human mind, for whatever reason, likes the interaction between words and images.
Yeah.
Whatever, who knows why, what that switch is, but it's there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think that this type of, you know, cartooning or graphic novels, that this medium, I don't think it's going to go away. It's going to morph into whatever it's going to morph into. But people want that, you know, visual, textual intersection. It speaks to them in some way that text just doesn't. I mean, you can look at any study where they talk about social media, you know, which tweets are clicked on the most and which parts of a website are clicked on the most. And they're, more than often than not, they're images of some sort.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And those, that's the entree into so many stories.
Yeah.
You know, as you said, I've got two adult daughters who are autistic, and they're incredibly visual.
Yeah.
And all of the reading and their vocabulary have come from the cartoons and from the comic strips and comic books and things like that they've read. So, I mean, it's out there, and it's important, I think.
Yeah. Well, and you think it, you know, in photojournalism, we don't have a problem with, you know, whether it's the anniversary of JFK, you had images from, you know, the Zapruder film that are iconic. And those are locked, you know, away. Or whether it's the shot, you know, of the massacre in Vietnam, you have powerful, or the Depression era photos,
mm-hmm.
and those stick with us. Or even the, you know, the World War II, you know, the victory shot, the kiss. Those we seem open to understanding why those are locked into our brains and why certain paintings, why we emotionally will have a feeling to water lilies or Vermeer, and so it's the biases that kick in. To me, look, illustration comics is a medium. Marjane Satrapi, the Persepolis writer who wrote a great memoir about, you know, her growing up in the middle of the Iran Revolution and the fall of the Shah, she talks about, she said, look, I thought comics were just a kid's medium.
Mm-hmm.
Then I read Art Spiegelman's Mouse, two books about his dad's experience, flashbacks and sort of narration going back to his dad's experiences as a concentration camp survivor. And, during the Holocaust, she said, then you get, oh, it's just a medium. It's comics, graphic novels. Some people call it a genre. It's not a genre, as you know. Genre is sci-fi, horror, romance. It's just another way, like whether you're terrestrial radio or whoever. It's just another means to get what you get, and it's as powerful and artful or not as that creator, those creators using it.
Now, I've read novels about World War II. I've mm-hmm. read books and articles about the Holocaust, mm-hmm. but I really didn't understand mm-hmm. the effect that it had on the people who were there, not even just the people who were there, but their children,
mm-hmm.
Until reading Mouse.
Yeah.
Because that was actually the surprising thing when I read that, was like, okay, we're going to get the parents' story, but then the impact that that had on this guy's life,
mm-hmm.
and how it sort of formed his psyche.
Absolutely.
And it completely changed my point of view about the way the Holocaust has been presented and the way people react to it.
Yeah.
and just how we need to bring that to get into our society and understand how things like that can happen. This has been really fascinating. Can you give me just a quick, you know, here are some things that people should be reading.
Mm-hmm.
There maybe you're like, you mentioned Mouse, but maybe older books, but things that even that are going on now, either as strips or comic books or graphic novels.
Oh yeah, where to begin? well, since you know, most people at this point, especially for an adult, you're either reading comic strips or not. But you know, I think online, Hark a Vagrant by Kate Beaton is one of the best because it engages you. It's so smart. I mean, she does her work about homework about history. Kate does, but she's so wry about it. So she might just spend a week on Andrew Jackson. And to me, she's been a breath of fresh air because she's what Tina Fey and Amy Poehler able to, the way they're able to skewer, especially some of the inherent sexism of Hollywood and the way they are able.
It's sexist?
Never. You know, the way they sort of, you know, after what, a century of the casting couch, the way that they are able slyly, even with just little, you know, digs to George Clooney or Leo DiCaprio. I mean, there's something else going on there. There's a reason they do that. And it's, you know, it's in history can be obviously sexist, you know. And so the, you know.
Trust nothing you read.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think that's what we should just go from.
Exactly. As I said, it's written by the winners, but often the winners turned out to be you know, if you pardon the language, sometimes they're the assholes who are willing to do anything to win, and so we get what we get.
To paraphrase Pogo.
Exactly.
I've met the asshole, and it is us.
Yes, very nice. Mr. Walt Kelly, no one said it like him. But so Kate Beaton, but, you know, I would look at some of the graphic novels I mentioned in this piece. One, we talked about, you know, more than 60 years ago, it was Congress trying to advertently or inadvertently drive a dagger through the much of the comics industry and crippling a lot of the creativity, that the comic book industry specifically. But now you had, in this past year, you had Congressman John Lewis, the civil rights icon, come out with book one of his memoir about civil rights. And it's a powerful book. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful book illustrated by Nate Powell. And Congressman Lewis has just done an amazing job. And I think I've said before, it should be in every school library, every classroom. But it's a great read for adults too, because you read this and you feel what it's like to be in Selma in 1965, the Edmund Pettus Bridge, and you feel what it's like to be tear gassed and beaten until and hauled off to jail until you're on the verge of death, and it's that powerful. I would also recommend Boxers and Saints about the Boxer Rebellion. It's two books looking at it from two sides, from the sides of the Christians, from the sides of the farmers, the Chinese farmers turned warriors, very powerful. Rutu Modan, Israeli graphic novelist, came out. She was known famous for Exit Wounds, but she came out with The Property. And that's also deals in present time, but with World War II, with her taps into her personal story about Polish relatives, two grandmothers who lost property and their homeland when they forcibly left Poland, but it's deeply personal too, and it has comedy too.
You know, I think the medium is so immersive.
Yes.
I don't know why. I think it's even more immersive than maybe even television or movies. I don't know if it's just because you're putting that part of your brain in that reads novels, where you're creating the images in your head, and somehow you've hooked it up with your eyes and it, I don't know. It's,
well, comics have tried, been deeply influenced by film. That we talk about, you know, when drawing a comic, is there a camera movement with how you read? And when I've talked to both Joe Simon, the co-creator of Captain America, and Stan Lee, they both cited in their early years, Citizen Kane is something that was profoundly influential because Orson Welles had so radically changed camera angle and movement in film. And so they were in New York, they were near Times Square, and they would go and watch Citizen Kane over and over and over to study the camera angles. And they said many other New York cartoonists did. And they would try to employ those tricks in their comics. So almost the very birth of comic books in the late 30s and early 40s, you know, I believe that film came out maybe 41.
Yeah.
You have them being influenced by film. So there's, to me, there's been a dialogue between film and comics for a long time. And Marjane Satrapi, the author of Persepolis, personifies that because she also does films like Chicken with Plums. Mm-hmm. And Persepolis is a beautiful film. She does live action and animation. And you see people like that who, and, you know, we know at Pixar, I've interviewed a number of directors at Pixar who were, some of them were comic strip cartoonists, some of them in college, you know, they were profoundly influenced. So there's an artistic dialogue that goes back and forth.
Yeah, Osamu Tezuka, who's was the king of manga in Japan,
yeah,
who pretty much started their entire manga industry and started their entire animation industry was deeply influenced by the Disney films of the 1930s and 40s. Mm-hmm. And that's why, piece of trivia today, that's why in Japanese manga the eyes are so big.
Yes.
Because
yes.
Those are Disney eyes.
Absolutely. And I've interviewed both Hayao Miyazaki, who has a film nominated for an Oscar now, The Wind Rises, and I talked to him and John Lasseter together at San Diego Comic-Con a few years back. And basically, you know, Lasseter's now heading up all Disney animation. But, you know, Miyazaki talked about being influenced by, among other things, Disney animation, among his influences. And then you, full circle, you have John Lasseter being influenced by Miyazaki. So you have a conversation across the ocean.
Miyazaki is such a genius.
Absolutely.
If you haven't seen
Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away is tremendous.
Nausicaa.
Ponyo.
Ponyo. All these films, and it's wonderful. I remember, you know, being an anime fan. And when the deal was signed that Disney was going to distribute it to them, at first it was like there was kind of, oh, no, Disney's going to ruin it. But then everybody's like, well, wait a second.
Yeah.
Disney is the exact right company to do it because clearly there are plenty of animators in that house that are going to say, look, this is a high art. We're going to deal. And they've done a really great job in releasing these films in America.
Absolutely. And I also write about animation on the blog. And one thing I will say for Pixar gets back to overcoming prejudices with content is with Pixar really got in a run. I mean, incredible legacy. Every Pixar film we expect to be moved, challenged. Mm-hmm. But when they had a run with like WALL-E and Up, Ellie's Song and Up,
they're
5 minutes.
They're just images. They're not real people.
They're exactly.
But they make you feel so much.
They move you. And so, and you have parents take their kids and then they're tearing up. And suddenly you say, okay, well, Pixar moves me, and they become a name brand. And you think of Toy Story 2 and Jessie's Song. So
then now I'm going to cry.
Right,
thank you.
I'm weeping. let me turn to the side here.
The podcast ends in tears.
I knew it would.
Oh,
see, comics can move you. You need newsprint and tissue, I think. The quality of the content is everything. It's a medium, and so with picture and with Ellie's Song and something like that, or you combine music, image.
Going at those heartstrings.
You go at those heartstrings. And so now, but adults are reminded once they're moved, that's not just a cartoon.
Right.
That's not the old prejudice. Oh, you're going to the cartoon show? No, you're reminded.
Do you know what that is? That's art.
That's art.
Art makes you feel.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it's supposed. That's its job.
That is it exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's end it there. I think it's a good place to end it.
Okay.
Thanks.
And on a smile.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Off the look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @AllJournalism.
The It's All Journalism podcast is produced in partnership with Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.